Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Welcome to the Drop the Needle podcast, your backstage pass to the corporate jungle. I'm your host, Jim Allstott, and here, industry titans step up to the mic, sharing their epic journeys. We're hitting the high notes and the low notes of their careers, creating a symphony of success. This isn't just another interview show. It's where truth bombs are dropped and secrets are revealed. So grab your conductor's baton, because who knows, this just might help you compose the next huge hit of your career. Are you ready? Let's go. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Drop the Needle podcast. I am your host, Jim Allstott, and I'm so happy you all decided to join us. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the challenges and the rewards in the life of a business owner, with some insights specifically related to owning a franchise. We are fortunate to have our guest today. We have Mr. Keith Muller, and Keith has over 25 successful store locations in the U.S. He's an owner of a cigar and wine bar as well, a pilot, and Keith is a true American entrepreneurial success story, and a friend of the show, by the way. Without further ado, friends, please join me in welcoming Mr. Keith Muller. Hey, Keith.
Hey, how's it going? I appreciate you having me on the show today.
Well, thanks for making the time for us. I really do appreciate it. And by the way, everything I said there was true. And one of the cool things I have to say is I had the opportunity to meet Keith in Costa Rica, believe it or not. We were both on a retreat, and we became fast friends because we realized we had a lot in common. So it was a great opportunity there. So I want to go ahead and dive right in, because I had mentioned in the opening the successful over 25 locations of a franchise, that sort of thing. And I'd imagine opening a franchise or starting a franchise is fairly involved, right? It's fairly involved process. Can you take us through a little bit of what goes on into opening a franchise?
Well, it scatters everywhere. You wind up having one, you have to find the passion that you want to, what it is you want to be involved in. Because if you're having to work at it, then it's going to fail. I mean, you got to love what you're doing. If you love it, it's not work. And then you don't mind putting in those 80 hours a week, whatever that is, you know. And then once you find that passion, I mean, this, you got to figure out where that window or door is of your opportunity. And then, of course, I mean, you got to come up with finances for it. And then it all just falls into place. But again, it's nothing that just falls on your lap. It's a matter of you got to search it.
Right.
Once you get there, then you just proceed it. I mean, I'm soon to be 65, I guess, retirement age, they say. I never worked a day in my life. I mean, I put in a whole lot of time, but I just love what I'm doing. So it didn't matter. I'd wake up thinking my business, and I'd go to bed thinking my business, but I smiled while I did it. So it was all awesome.
That's fantastic. You know, and I think what's the old saying? If you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. Something like that.
Exactly.
I think you're living proof of that then. And you're fortunate, by the way, because I can't tell you how many times you hear, and I'm sure you do too, you're out there and somebody goes, oh, I hate what I do. I hate what I do. And you find out, let's say that they went to school or something like that. And gosh, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but how many times have you heard somebody that went to school for something that they had a passion about, whether that be art or music in my case, and they may have started doing something with it or maybe never did anything with it. And they just kind of fall flat on that fulfillment side of things. So I think you're one of the few people that enjoy that stuff.
It's a matter of finding purpose in your life. I mean, you had mentioned, right, I'm a pilot. For those, I'm a general aviation pilot. I don't fly in a big boy jet at all. But I mean, when I was young and growing, that's my passion, was to actually be a pilot, an airline pilot.
Wow.
Recognizing as I got to that age to pursue that career, I just didn't have the financial ability to even go forward with that. I mean, it's expensive to learn how to fly a big jet. I mean, there's that can become in the Air Force and learn to fly those jets, and then they transition over. But that's kind of like becoming an NBA star. There's only a certain few that are
able
to do that. So it just wasn't in my cards. So yeah. I later figured out if I pursued something and wound up having another or a little bit of disposable income, I could then just pursue learning how to fly smaller airplanes just to fill that void of wanting to do that.
Sure, that passion itch. That's, well, you know, and it's funny. I have a friend of mine whose son went to college, and his initial plan was, I'm going to go into the Air Force, I'm going to graduate, be an officer, and fly jets, right? And that's a great dream and a great aspiration to have. But as he was in his first year, and I guess it's your first semester, your sophomore year, you have to commit. And at that point in time, you say, okay, U.S. government, Uncle Sam, I'm yours for the next six or seven years. And when he was in there and going through the program, he was just like, you know what? They keep telling me there's no guarantee that I'm going to be a pilot when I'm done with this. Right. And I could be somewhere doing something I have no passion for or desire to do. So my buddy's son decided, yep, I'm going to go a different direction. And he did. And you're right about the expenses for that. Even in like a college program, you know, as far as fees are concerned, airtime was not included. And the number that he gave me was like a like somebody buying a condo or something. Oh, yeah. You know,
I mean, you get into, you can be in a semester and learning a multi-engine course, and that's $35,000 just for that. Oh, I mean, and that's just one step of your next process. So it's some people can do it. Some people figure out how to do it. I just,
right,
I didn't have the knowledge and or ability to make that happen for me.
Well, which, you know what?
Actually, it worked out for my better anyways.
I was just going to say, I think things worked out okay for you, by the way. So when you mentioned financing, you mentioned that there are a number of things that go into opening up the franchise. So when you're starting out, when you just say, okay, you're doing your due diligence and you say, I want to open a franchise, ABC franchise, what's one of the first things that you need to go into that with? You know, and I'm doing this because the program is set so we can pay it forward a little bit, because I know there are people out there, because I've actually spoken with somebody recently that started to do some investigation on it. And I said, well, if you hang tight, I'm going to have somebody that's been very successful with opening franchises on, and we can hopefully answer some questions for you.
Well, I mean, truly, if there, you just can't open a magazine and say, all right, this is a franchise, it's a great opportunity, I'm going to do it. Cold turkey, that's ridiculous. Whatever you think you might want to do, you might want to put your feet in the water first. So get a job at whatever location you're looking at.
Ooh, or yeah.
Even talk with the owner of that individual to say, hey, I'm looking to commit my life into this, get some feedback from them. But you want to put some hours in whatever that business is. To one, to understand it, two, to observe how other people do it. It's amazing. You know, people run businesses differently. So you want to at least, I mean, there may be some really hidden secret that you can pick up from that individual or that store location. You may realize this operation is really effed up. And boy, if I ran this, I'd run it differently.
Sure.
But just go open-mindedly knowing that just because you think your idea is the best way to do things, sometimes it's not. There's a reason why people do what they do. You need to learn that reason. You can tweak it, but usually there's a system that's functioning.
Right, right. Especially if you're going into some of the more established franchises that are out there. I suppose, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the magazine, Open Up a Magazine, and that was actually where an acquaintance that I was talking to had mentioned that. And I was like, right. Well, where'd you find out about that? Well, interestingly enough, I was reading this magazine and I was like, okay. And, you know, you set up your appointment and then they'll do a financial check on you. They'll run your credit and all this other stuff. And he was saying that he needed to have X number of dollars of liquid assets in order to get started with it. And it was a pretty substantial amount, to the point where I think he was talking about cashing in his 401k. And I was like, well, you might want to pump the brakes a little bit on that before you do that. And
if it becomes a passion, I mean, I think I lost my life a number of times financially, but I always look at it as, all right, so I see the end of that tunnel. But I also, when I went into these franchises, I built a few and I picked up a few. When you pick up a franchise from somebody else, usually they're not getting out because they're making a whole lot of money in it. They're getting out for it because it's becoming a strap, a burden, or what.
Right.
But I always went in looking at it. So nobody operates a business to fail.
Right.
So then figure out why is that restaurant failing? It could be a location that is failing. In that case, then maybe you want to just give it some thought if you really need this location or not, or if there are obstacles or barriers that you can overcome and fix.
That's a good point. Location. You know,
there's a number of things you got to witness. Just don't assume somebody's getting out and you're going to come in and take it over and, you know, that golden goose or cash cow is just going to start performing.
Right. Fix all their problems.
It doesn't happen that way.
And right.
When somebody gets out, there's a reason they're getting out. There's something they know or just don't want to deal with anymore. So you got to be open-minded and figure it.
Yeah. And that's very true. It's, you know, it's not like the old car days where somebody's buying a used car. Well, my grandma drove this to church on Sundays, you know, one of those deals where it's a deal too good to be true. But, so we're talking about doing the due diligence. You talked a little bit about the operational aspects, location. So with that in mind, let's say that you're going into this and you're not going to pick up somebody else's business that they're wanting out of. How much say do you have in choosing a location for your potential franchise?
Well, again, with a question like that, that varies from your franchisee. Most companies that franchise out, usually they have their rules and regulations and they pretty much determine where things are going to be located.
Gotcha.
You might be able to, if you have some insight with them, give them some direction. If you can give them a business case on why, they may be open to it. but most of the time they have real estate practices, they have research that determines. And again, right. depending upon the unit itself, that also determines, you know, what location or where you're going to be in the first place.
And that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. So when you open up these franchises, and I'm sure it varies, but there's probably some similarities that could be, you know, across the board. So let's say that it is in a retail franchise. And as far as like the build outs and different things like that, who does that or who decides that? Is it usually under that umbrella of the franchise that makes those?
And again, very depending upon what company you're going to be working with or partnering with, many times to keep a consistency, because if that's the beauty of a franchise, is they remain right. consistent. They will probably offer you a minimum selection of choices, that being whether building design, kitchen packages, who's the distribution. And so they've already have done their homework and have kind of set you up for that. It's a double-edged sword. It makes right. it easier because you don't have to think while you're running your business. But then sometimes you kind of question the pricing of who you're having to use.
Yeah, gotcha.
Because usually franchisees will cut deals with whoever's going to be distributing. And usually in that negotiation, there's kind of a profit guarantee at some point in time. So
gotcha.
Because they want to remain friends with whoever that distribution is. And that sometimes as the smaller guy on the ladder or on the stool, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm. You have a tendency to question, why am I paying so much for what this item A when I could go to a Sam's Club and buy that almost same item for, you know, 40% less.
Right. Right. And I know that to be true from, so that's very interesting. My, a family member was a restaurateur and also sold alcohol in their establishment. And it was a situation where you have to go through certain distributors. And I forget what he was saying that, let's just throw out a number. It was $32 for a case of Coors Light
right.
that he would have to pay. And I was like, $32? Are you kidding me? It, you know, he was almost paying double on that, but that was just like part of the deal because then it opened the door to get some other things that he was looking for in his restaurant in terms of different, you know, liquor products or packages.
Right.
And I was amazed. And he just said that they'd have like two or three different distributors for their alcohol because one couldn't give you everything. Or they had two,
right.
And he had multiple locations, but it was really interesting because you're right. You could just go to Sam's or Costco or the local grocery store and get something for a fraction of what you were having to pay through that distributor, but it's just part of the deal.
Yeah. And a lot of times in that particular case, you know, alcohol is usually managed or run by, overseen by the state. So some distributors right. may not be allowed to import cross lines, whatever product that is, where they are given allowance to pick up something else. So that's kind of another reason that you also have to understand that side of the business as well.
Yeah. I didn't even think about that. You're right. It's not like you can go buy a case of something and throw it in your car and, right. you know, bring it into the restaurant.
As you brought up the cigar and wine bar, we sell, craft beers and regular beers, also a number of wonderful wines. But again, I use a number of different distribution centers on that as well because of regulations by the state.
Sure, which is it's very cool. And by the way, we're definitely going to spend some time in that arena talking about that business for sure.
We could have been face-to-face and you could have flown in and we could
Hell yeah. participated. I, you know what, maybe there'll be a follow-up episode that requires something like that because I'm all in on that for sure. So what are some of the great things? We talked about some of the pitfalls. What are some of the great things about owning a franchise?
Well, again, what I'm involved in is it's just a natural passion. I mean, I enjoy it. I can't wait to get up and start up another day. One of the values I had picked up while running these things, and I kind of carry this throughout everything I do, is let everybody be a part of it and find people that have similar passions as you. I'm dumb as rocks.
I doubt that, seriously.
And there's a lot of things. I went through middle school or something, or high school, and they set you up with a counselor. And this one counselor said, write your name in script. And I wrote my name in script. And she looked at it and says, you're a visionary. I'm a visionary. She says, yeah, I can tell that by your handwriting. And I was, how can you come up with that? And she says, well, if you look at your first initial, I mean, it's very big and broad and stands out. And then I use my first two initials of my first and middle name. And then I write out my last name. And once I get through to my capital of my last name, that could be noticed. And then all of a sudden it just falls out, gets sloppy and falls out through almost a doctor's.
I've been accused of that myself. Yeah.
And what she pointed out was you're interested in a startup. You don't care about the details or the outcome as long as it gets done. And I mean, it was spot on.
Wow.
I find the people that I surround myself with, I look down, I mean, because everybody's.
You look at their signatures.
I don't have that abilities, but I mean, I reckon there are people that enjoy the minutia of doing things.
Yes, definitely.
And there are some that can focus on the final outcome. So you just kind of, when you have a meeting, you bring them all together and you start up, which is good because I guess I'm theory as the boss. I can make the announcements of where we're going to go, and then I'll just, how are we going to get there?
Right.
Groups into it, and then you just finalize at the end.
That's excellent. No, that, yeah, there's a lot of similarities in what you're saying between you and I in that regard, because it's just, I want to get it done. I don't necessarily want to get caught up in the details of all of that. I just see this needs to get done. Let's just get it done. That's fantastic. And that was actually, I was hoping you would bring up the team aspect, because it, success doesn't happen in a vacuum, right?
Not at all. And anybody that thinks that they did everything, I mean, there may be a small percentage that have. They're taking the credit for things that other people have done. I mean, I don't believe that at all. I mean, like I say, I'll be the first to admit, I don't know nothing.
Well, I don't know. Again.
But I mean, it's everybody that I'm around have the ability to make things happen. They just need somebody to kind of beat them into the line that they need to go.
Well, what I think you do know very well is to put the right people in place around you. I mean, that is, I want to say an art form, but what it really ends up being is that's a habit that's been developed, or a muscle or a skill, is my guess, over a period of time with you, that you just notice that that's what I have to do. And by doing that, this is my, the guidelines for success for me. I need, this is me, and these are the parts that come in to get to Z success, you know? So no, there, you know that. Well, and that's tough.
That's not something that was natural. Truly. And I think I'd mentioned this to you at some point in time. I used to micromanage everything because nobody could do anything better than I believed that I could. I had, I guess I ran fewer franchises at the time, like I said, but I'd have a meeting, and then by that afternoon, I'd be calling up everybody that the meeting was with, and so where are we at with it? And I go up tomorrow, and where are we at? And I thought we were, and what happened was, I guess I had taken a trip to, we went over to Vietnam or Hong Kong, or anyway, I wound up picking up a blood disorder while I was overseas.
Oh my God.
Literally almost killed me. I wound up being in the hospital for like 3 months.
Holy shit.
I wound up being released. I mean, when I was in the hospital, they brought the priest in for your
get out of here.
And so what happened was, it was the scariest thing I've ever gone through, but it was the best thing that ever happened. Because while I was in this hospital, I was basically, fighting, concerned about my life and my existence.
Right.
And the business just kind of fell apart, or in my mind, it fell apart. And so I would contact my people, but not on a daily, hourly basis, regularly.
Right.
And then so after about 3 months, and then I was finally released out of the hospital, and then just, of course, because I had to get back in the office and see where we're at. And so I pulled all my hair out. I don't have any hair anymore. But I wound up, what I recognized was while I was out, I had all this talent that I was allowing to do what they do best. Most of the time, better than I would have ever imagined.
That's awesome. So that's awesome.
The epiphany was, maybe you don't have to micromanage these people. Just let them do what they want to do and perform. And I mean, things were running far better than I could have ever imagined.
I guess you don't need me now. Right. That's fantastic, though. Too bad that had to almost die for it to happen. But
it was the best thing that ever happened. I mean, that's crazy. Once you go through a series like that, your perspective of life changes, your appreciation of friends and family changes. It's just
heck yeah.
You look at every day as a different process.
So that's interesting, because when I met you, you're put together. You're put together, dude. And I mean, like, physically fit. But I gotta tell you, at first I was like, what's this guy all about? And the first thing you did is put your hand out and you go, you know what? I'm more of a hugger than a handshaker. And you gave me a hug and you just said, I've heard so much about you. I'm so glad we finally got to meet. And talk about totally disarming. You know, anything that could have been going through my head is when you first impressions or anything.
Right.
The only first impression I had is I like this guy already. That was the first impression that I had of you, because it was like in that room, I'm sure you've been in rooms before with people, and it was a crowd. It was an airport, right? And lots of people, and you're looking at people, checking them out and going, okay, what's he? Especially these days, it always seems like you're on alert to a certain degree, which is sad in and of itself. But then to meet you, it was just like, it was totally disarming. And it was very cool. I don't know where the hell I was going with that, other than the fact that first impression of meeting you was eye-opening, from the standpoint that you have this calm and confidence about you that I'm wondering, was that something that developed over time, or is that something that you had?
Well, first of all, I'm flattered you said something like that. Thank you. You kind of said I threw you off kilter when I gave you a hug.
Yeah.
Quite honestly, I was very, I grew up very standoffish.
Okay.
But when I got in this, once you got in the franchise, working for a corporation, especially corporations in the 80s, 90s, where, and I don't mean this in a stereotypical way or a negative way whatsoever, many companies had start promoting females, mm-hmm. and diversity. So back then, most women that were, because it was in theory a man's world, or at least they
sure
believed that, they all taught, they were all taught and took the avenue of that manly firm handshake, and you had to say, you know, greet whoever it was, good to meet you kind of a thing. And again, just to play a game and have fun, because everybody's always tense with meet and greets. Yes. I started saying, I don't shake hands, I hug. But because I didn't want to be centered out, so I started hugging all the guys in the company too.
Is that right? Okay.
This way they would be saying, you know, for whatever reasons.
Right.
It became a joke. So everybody, I'm a hugger. You know, it's kind of the Italian in me. I'm not Italian, but.
But if you were.
Right. So I mean, and that's where that happened. And what I figured out, it, because it did, but when you were meeting somebody and you hugged them, because everybody's in the corporate lifestyle, that it kind of made it a family aspect.
Right.
And either one threw them off, or two gave them a different impression. And when you're dealing with a company or a corporation, you have seconds to make an impression with somebody.
True.
So that they'll, the guy that you remembered, the guy that hugged me, I remember him. So that I was, anytime I would meet somebody for the second time, they were already prepared or knew me. Whereas I didn't have to reintroduce myself or.
That's amazing.
It's a social game is all it is.
No, but it's that's fantastic though. The psychology that goes behind that is amazing. And whether your intent was that, or it was something after doing it, there was a reflection.
Well, that was
genius.
It was a learning piece of that, because I recognized the response you got. But I mean, it's nothing that we don't always do anyway. We just don't apply it. I mean, as you think about, you're always, when you're in a big group, you're always trying to figure out how to stay, if you need to, how to stand out or be the mm-hmm. wallflower. And you only have seconds, because yeah, I mean, I'm a believer. Most people, whatever your first impression is, that's how you're labeled in a group. Most of the time.
Yeah, that is true.
Unless you have an opportunity to start massaging and working on a relationship. But I mean,
right.
In a corporate life, you don't have that.
Not very often. Not very often. And it's subsequent meetings if you get those. So that's interesting, though. And I'll tell you, it was incredibly effective with me, especially in... And I guess maybe it's generational or what have you. I know from my family upbringing, they weren't huggers, right?
Same as mine. No, my family was no different than that.
Yeah, that's a great thing to incorporate in a family, to do that, though. You know what I mean? Because it didn't go down like that in your family doesn't mean that's not a good idea to start.
Well, I mean,
to
but what you also have to learn, and it's at my age, I always went into my locations, and I mean, I'd hug everybody. And then it was brought to my attention, you know, everybody, some of these everybody's are late teens, early 20s, and I'm this one guy going in and hugging. And,
yeah,
that's kind of creepy. So I backed off.
I get that, and I guess it's too bad that has to happen, but there's probably reasons
because I go in and out all the time, so once everybody kind of recognized me, and so I sometimes you can feel somebody's uncomfortable, or you can see if somebody's uncomfortable if you're walking up to them and you start to stiffen up a little bit. You explain yourself.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Put the camera on, so we see that this is.
Nothing more. Yeah, right. Nothing more. Hands above the waist. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. No. That's great. That's great. Man, I love that. The fact that it's learned, and that's one of those things too. That this is not trying to get up on a soapbox, but I will just for a second. It's never too late to change. It's never too late to learn something new. It's never too late to reinvent yourself. You know, if you think that it is, then unfortunately it is, right? Because where you're energy goes, what is it, where your mind goes, your energy flows, or something like that. So if it's, if you're thinking that I'm too old, I'm too this, I'm too that, you're not going to be able to change. And that's another piece of this when meeting you. I have to think much like myself. So I'm usually the unicorn in these settings with coaching and, right, and seminars and the retreat. And it was very nice to see another male there because it doesn't usually happen. But where I'm going with this is you have an openness, it seems to me, to try something before, you know, you could immediately go, yeah, not going to do that. Not going to do yoga. Not going to do, not. As opposed to, yeah, I'll be there. I'm going to do this. I'm going to try this. And and not to blow smoke up your ass, that was inspirational to me to know that it's okay. It's okay. You're not going to be an expert at everything. And how do you know you're not going to like something? You've got to try something in order to know that you either do or you don't. And that was really cool to see too, because I think that there's confidence, there's openness, there's self-awareness, and that's a good way to go through life, I think.
Yeah, but in fairness, I didn't know anybody there, so I can make a fool of myself and not have to worry about it.
That's true.
You get online and everybody gets, oh, remember what Jim did?
Yeah, I'm sure that's come up a few times, but I guess so. But it's still it was still cool to just, you know, put yourself out there and not really worry about it. Because it didn't seem like you were too concerned.
In fairness, I don't give it. I don't know where the beeps come out, but
no, you actually, it's an explicit show, so you can swear. That I don't give a shit attitude, and it's not that you don't care, but you don't care what somebody else thinks.
It's not going to affect my circle.
Right. Which, God bless you for that, because there's way too many people that get paralyzed by that stuff, you know? And it's sad because they never realize what they could really accomplish. They're scared all the time.
I don't disagree with that statement whatsoever.
That's very cool. Well, speaking of very cool, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the cigar and wine bar shop. I'm wondering, when you opened that, was there much of a difference between the franchise and opening that business? Or?
Everything's the same. Everything's different. It depends on how detailed and in-depth you want to get.
Gotcha.
The cigar shop actually started out, I used to, when finishing up a day, I'd get on a motorcycle and drive to, we had a next town over was a cigar shop. So I'd go smoke a cigar semi-regularly out there. Got to meet, as you know, you smoke cigars. The beauty of a cigar is you can have no knowledge of whoever's sitting beside you, but you have that one commonality, that cigar in your hand. And that always opens up conversation. You know, what are you smoking? How long you been smoking that? And what do you also like? I mean, and then from that, it just into more conversation.
Yeah.
And so it was just, it was a Cheers shop for me. You know, that old show Cheers. Where
no, yes. One, yeah.
That's all. Anyway, small shop, great people, ran pretty well, nothing great. And then I went to a cigar event that she was having, and I was talking with one of the distributors with a General Cigar at the time. They were doing a punch event or something. And I'm talking with Mike, and he said, man, I just can't believe the conversation I had with Michelle. Michelle was the cigar owner. Mm-hmm. And she's just tired of the business and thinking about getting out. She's tired of dealing with all these men. And I mean, that's most of the time. Shop, you know? And so anyway, so about a week later, I didn't see Michelle at the shop, and I said, rumor has it you're considering about selling. And she went and she, oh, yeah, well, I'm thinking about it. I'm getting the, going through. I'm tired. And, da, da, da. And I said, well, you know, I've always loved being here. Much as I spend here, maybe if I buy it, I can
get some fund your retirement.
I can buy it cost. Anyway, so I might be anyway. So we spent probably about a month trying to negotiate a price of her shop. And through the process, it was obvious she was just fishing, seeing where every time we'd come up with an offer, counter offers weren't in between. They usually go up. They were going higher. So, and at that time, they had a, she had a manager there who was, he was the personality of the shop. Everybody went there because of Tim, the guy. Mm-hmm. And Tim was, I mean, he was a prick. I mean, really, he would tell you, he'd tell you the truth. I mean, you'd say something, he'd call you an asshole if you were being an asshole. He was the personality. He cut you back down to the ground where you should have been in the first place. And everybody respected him and loved him for it. And it became a game, and everybody just throws stuff back. Anyway, Tim was promised a lot while working for Michelle. And it was a carrot. Carrot just kept on getting moved, just like right. She was raising the price every night. Anyway, so I told at the time Tim was going to quit, and I had told Tim, you know, I'm sure you know I'm looking at this shop. I know what you've been promised. I hope you can judge my character enough that I guarantee. I even told him, I said, man, you're the reason why everybody comes here. It's nothing to do with Michelle. It's nothing to do with this shop. It's your personality is here. And I need you here if I'm going to buy this thing. I promise whatever she offered to you, I will make happen. I will make it. So I'm not going to move that here. Anyway, so he hung out. He stayed with Michelle. Then finding out, I told him, I said, look, this isn't going to happen. He quit within a week.
Oh, really?
So anyway, I was driving down. I passed her shop and then a different location I had seen opened. And I pulled in because they had a couple of spaces that were for lease. And it turns out I went to school with a guy on the building.
Get out of here.
I called him up and I said, I thought you were selling this building. I had heard you were trying to sell this building. He says, I am. I said, but I'm still managing it. So I made the guy, I said, well, you know, all I know is a fully functioning strip shopping center will sell better than a half empty shopping center. So I might be interested in picking up your empty two slots. And then we wound up negotiating, cutting a deal. So he discounted me, and it was extended for 5 or 7 years or something.
Nice.
So when he would get out, it would still have to be honored. Anyway, called up Tim and said, hey, for what I was planning on offering for the shop, you want to just open one up? Yeah, I'd love to do that. So anyway, we wound up.
How cool. Yeah,
we called up all his, well, I shouldn't say, all of Michelle's clients. Because we had access to them. I knew them all anyway. And invited them up to our breaking ground, for a better term. We had a breaking ground party that they all showed up.
How cool. Yeah. And what
really became cool of this is while I was still at the other shop investigating or trying to value everything, you know, I was being known up at the shop as the guy that's going to buy the shop.
Uh-huh.
So again, the commonality of a cigar, you're sitting there and somebody would sit down, hey, I understand you're going to think about buying the shop. And everybody would always say, boy, I wish I was you. Or I would sure love to do something like that. I'm envious. And I'd always stop them and say, hey, so if you were me and you did buy this place, I mean, shop's okay. But I mean, what would you do different to make this better? And everybody.
Great question.
I mean, so you know, if we only had widescreen TVs, or you know, if they got rid of these chairs and gave us leather couches, or you know, just everybody had just something. You know, if they only collected or stocked this or humidor. Anyway, so most what we did is we called up all the core people and brought them to our groundbreaking. And then I bought a couple cases of beer, bought a couple boxes of cigars, and we're all just in the parking lot, passing them all around and cracking and smoking.
That's great.
said, guys, so by the way, I hope y'all know why you're here. If not, you know, Albert, member of the cigar shop, welcome to the cigar shop. We're going to call it that. I really like that name. And then we opened up the door, walked in, and Tommy, remember you were talking about wanting leather chairs? Well, we're thinking leather chairs over here, and Billy, that widescreen TV, going to be over there, and we're thinking about, you know, Bobby, that bar in the back, we're going to do it, set it up. Hey, so every time like somebody told me they wanted something to make it better, we put it in the build. So wow. I had 15 guys, her core customers, fighting at the bit for this shop to open because it was their shop. This is my idea.
How cool.
They all had ownership in the shop. They got to, we were building this thing out, and every Saturday, we gave them all keys to go into the building, which is probably stupid. I didn't have insurance. So every Saturday, they sat on lawn chairs.
Keith won't mind if I take this.
They sat on lawn chairs in the shop, an unfinished shop.
That is so awesome.
And to a point where then when we finally opened the shop up, we didn't have any employees. I had temp. That was it. And I don't run a cash register. I mean, I don't know enough. I know what I like, but I can't give any guidance. Anyway, so these core guys, when they were there, if we got busy, hey, Albert, go in the humidor and help them out. So they'd go run out there, and then we let them run the cash register. We gave them the keys.
Get out. So
for 5 months, I had my core customers, which were my big money spenders, were running my shop.
That's genius, by the way. I mean, that's genius. Talk about deputizing everybody that was important in that entire process and was knowledgeable and was, you know, they were free to give, you know, their input or thoughts on something. How cool is that? And the lawn chair thing, that totally would have been me. That totally would have been me. Oh my gosh. Man, how cool. What a great story.
The shop, we wound up, I had built a bar in the back of this place. Problem was I didn't do my homework and read the ordinances. I set it up for, I had mixers there, and then I was letting people come in and put whatever they were drinking in their lockers.
Okay.
Or basically brown bagging. And the county did not allow brown bagging.
So oh, really?
I guess somebody told on us or whatever, and we got citationed, and we just kind of, oh, okay, it won't happen again. And we got citationed the next week, and then the next week we got citationed again, and the cop said, look, one more citation and we're closing this place.
Oh my gosh.
So we had to stop that. We wound up, we talked to a couple of commissioners of the county, also partake and smoke cigars and stuff, and we were telling them
it's good to have friends,
the problems we were having, and they said, well, what we need to do is just change the ordinances of the county. So we wrote the ordinance for premium cigar shops of alcohol beverages. So we wrote the ordinance for the county, and so now we sell beer and wine.
The
beer and wine thing was, I was just gonna let's put a diet beer or a Coors Light and a Coors, or a house red and a house white wine, and everybody will be fine. And similar to the way we stocked up our cigar shop, the people said, well, why don't you have this or why don't you have that? And we said, look, we'll get whatever we can get, but you got to promise to buy it. If you don't buy it, I'll never get it again. I mean, and that's how I guess we wound up introducing more and more flavors of cigars. Same thing with the wines. To a point now, we're probably, I was talking to a distributor, and he was telling me I'm in the top 5 wine selection.
Get out of here. That's something. That's something up and coming. Yeah, that's, man, I remember when we were in Costa Rica, you told me a story about how you became one of the top, like an A-rated distributor for Fuentes. It was the Opus.
With the Opus X.
Yeah. Where, you know, well, you had somebody coming in.
We did a lot of fundraisers with Carlos.
Okay.
And so with those fundraisers, we wound up, I guess the story that you're talking about, we wound up, we didn't have the Opus account originally. So we found out he had a charity. We made a major contribution to the charity. So at least the name got popped up to the top of the list. Right. Flipping through things.
Strategic.
So we submitted some requests. And I had a meeting with him because we were going to do a fundraiser for his cigar family charity. So I had a meeting with Carlos, and then he was kind of going through records and pointed out what we were getting. And at that time, Opus, that was in the early 90s, and Opus X was like the
cigar. Yeah.
It was in, yeah. I mean, it was like you can get a Cuban easier than you can get an Opus X.
Right.
So my conversation with him is we're really trying to get an Opus account and going through some walls. But, you know, we understand it's marketing, and we understand, you know, supply and demand. I said, not stupid. I said, but I do want to let you know that if and when we do get those cigars, most of the shops around me, and I'm sure you know, but if you don't, you know, they wind up hoarding those boxes. And then they've got their favorite customer that's going to offer them stupid money for them. They're going to pay them cash, and that transaction is going to take place. I said, and I said, Carlos, that's just wrong. I said, the cigar is so good. Everybody reads about it, but nobody gets to smoke.
Right.
Just stupid rich. I said, if I ever got that account, I said, you would only be able to buy one of those out of a box. I said, because this way, I'll sell the box. I'll sell it out in a day. But I said, 25 people will smoke your cigar, not one.
Right.
And he said, you would do that? And I said, God damn right I would do it. I said, I told him, my shop's shits and giggles. I want everybody to enjoy cigars. I'm not going to make a lip. And I didn't hug him. I wish I did it.
He'd have never forgotten you.
That stuck with him. And then we got a phone call. And then we went from, I guess, a C level to an A level. A level is when everybody gets a box of 25, my boxes are 250.
Wow.
And we still do that today. We sell, you can only buy one cigar a day.
Wow. They're still on that holy grail list for a lot of folks.
It's a great cigar.
Yeah.
But I mean, as you know, there are a lot of great cigars.
You know what? That's one of those things that I've found in, you know, there's some, okay, so the Cuban cigars are always, you know, one of those things that people go after. And I can say that there are some Cuban cigars that are just absolutely fantastic. But I think that there's also something about the allure of the Cuban hand-rolled cigars and everything.
Well, the thing about, too. If you remember, go back in the 80s, when if you were on the West Coast or west of the Mississippi, you could buy a Coors beer.
Right.
You couldn't get Coors if you were on the east of the Mississippi.
That's right.
But Smokey and the Bandit made a movie about it.
Yes.
And so everybody thought Coors, if you had your hands on a can of Coors, I mean, this is the best beer ever. It was all this marketing, and I mean, it was the fact, supply and demand. The things you can't have, you want.
You want. That's right.
And I mean, Cubans are kind of the same way when it comes. I mean, and think about Cuba. I mean, Cuba runs the farms for the Cuban tobacco.
Right.
And
yeah,
they go
yeah.
through and they rate those and determine who's going to get the leaves. You know, Cohiba's usually on the top, Monte Cristo, and it kind of right. goes down from there. And farmers, I guess they're allowed to keep 10% of their product or crop, and then they can do whatever they want with that tobacco. Mismanaging crop rotation, I mean, that's possibly so, but I mean, the reality of it is, you know, everything is seasonal. It's like wine.
Right.
Wines are the same way. I mean, you have a good growing season, you have a bad growing season, or not as good.
Sure.
So that determines the quality of your cigar.
Yeah, you know, and this is, I always take those stories as being, you know, it's information in, and you go, okay, because at the end of the day, it's one of those things where people will say, well, what's your favorite cigar? And I was like, I don't know, usually the one I have in my hand.
Right.
Because, but seriously, I don't know that I can honestly say that I have a favorite because I like so many and for different reasons, different occasions. And you hit on it, which is one of the things that I truly believe this when it comes to cigar smoking. I tell somebody, you know, when they say, can you recommend a cigar for me? Well, a cigar is like wines, like bourbons, like beers, and anything else. It's up to that person's palate,
right,
to determine whether or not they like it or they don't like it. So I'm always apprehensive about this. So I try to give some explanation of what it is. But where I'm going with this, cigar smoking to me is a social circle. And you talked about that, where it's that common ground. And the next thing you know, you're spending 45 minutes talking, smoking that cigar with somebody, laughing, and they're usually telling stories of some sort, and you're picking up different things. And that's one of my favorite things about the cigar smoking crowd, if you will, or those people, is that I'm not really a fisherman. Was never really had a huge, huge desire to go fishing. But when I do go fishing, it's not to catch the fish. It's to sit and talk to whomever I'm fishing with, if that makes sense. It's just kind of the same way.
Most people play golf. None of them are good at it. They play cigars, right. Beer, and talk. Is all they
That's right. That's right. It's a social event, a social happening, and it's one of those things that I get a lot out of, quite honestly. But so I will say this. If you're new to the podcast, there's a section in every podcast that we have, and I know this is an abrupt switch, but we're dialing in on our time frame here. But every podcast we have a musical section because, as I often say, music is the tie that binds, and I truly believe that everybody has a soundtrack that accompanies their life. So this is a section where we're going to go through some of those musical questions. Are you cool with that?
How about it?
Okay. So I ask everyone these questions because everybody's songs are so far have been different. What's the first song that you fell in love with from the radio or that you heard and remember saying, oh, I can't wait to hear that song again?
It's A Beautiful Morning by the Rascals.
That is a great song. That's a great song. And not surprising. I don't know why. I'm not surprised by that at all. Damn. Okay, so growing up, did your family ever have a song that you're in the family truckster going someplace on vacation or what have you that everyone would belt out when they heard it?
They normally, when we did a family trip once a week every year as I was a kid growing up. Usually it was an AM radio in the car back then.
Right. Yep.
You know, so you were listening. My father was always listening to, I don't even know what he was listening to, but they grew up in the big band era. So we always heard, you know, Benny Goodman and all that stuff.
Yeah.
My mom, I don't know if I mentioned, my mom was a Rockette growing up. So she was more of a show tuner listening to that.
No kidding. No, you did not.
No, no.
Holy cow.
Yeah,
so
she was one of the things. So she was a Rockette 40 to 42. And the joke I had with her all the time was, so mom, you know, back then, I got to assume, you know, first couple rows were probably just men trying to look up your legs. Well, I was like, girl, I said, so an S is, you know, you're kind of back then a pole dancer of today.
Oh my God.
Which always sparked a little bit of a agitation.
A slap?
She knows that was a kid.
That's awesome. That's good stuff. So, and that's one of those things that, I didn't mention, but you were born and raised to, was it middle school in New York and then,
correct.
And then made the journey down south
to Georgia.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good stuff.
Yeah. That was a culture shock for sure.
Well, yeah, it was for me when I moved from Chicago to Atlanta. Well, I lived in Smyrna and then Marietta and then up and coming. So it was a little bit. So there's another question that I ask about hype songs, right? And those change from, can be day to day, week to week, year to year, what have you. But what are your top five songs on your hype playlist that make you absolutely want to go out and crush stuff?
Well, again, it's like we were talking about cigar smoking. It depends on what the day's going to entail. If it's going to be got to go out and take names and kick ass, or if it was going to be, I'm going to go out in the sunshine and just chill.
Yeah.
But I guess now if I was doing kick ass stuff, definitely I follow the genres more than just a specific song.
Sure.
But I would definitely jump into Metallica.
Oh, hell yeah.
I'm a big AC/DC fan and Van Halen fan too.
So, you know, the Metallica, that's funny because I usually try to go into this without any preconceived notions or ideas as to where somebody's going to go. But for some reason, I just had you pegged as somebody on that hype list would have like Metallica, like Enter Sandman or something. I was like, oh.
The genres, I listen to classical too, so I go across the board.
And me too.
Jethro Tull, which is kind of a spin from rock to classical.
Yes. Yeah. You know what? So my mom wasn't a rockette, but my mom sang, and she was actually in Doc Severinsen. She was in a touring group and was recorded with Doc Severinsen from the old Tonight Show, Johnny Carson back then.
Actually, so, we knew Doc Severinsen.
Really?
Oh, my mom did. So
yeah.
We knew him.
Yeah. Cool dude. But yeah, so the musical tastes that I have are very eclectic, and I've been able to successfully pass that down to my sons, my three boys. It's like my oldest was an 80s kid, you know, 80s high schooler like me, because I mean, he just listens to that stuff in our garage, is especially during COVID was where he would work out for his college football team, right. And he would have his teammates come and they would all, and I just make it a rule that they couldn't have more than 10 in there at a time because it get too crowded and they're standing around. But so they'd come in waves, and he'd have his 80s playlist going for both of those. And by the time they were able to get back to school, those kids were still rocking. They'd be rolling up to the house and you'd be hearing like Running with the Devil. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not kidding. It was like he converted them. Oh, he was an 80s rock band evangelist or something. It's kind of crazy, but yeah, it's excellent. So I know you said you don't have, you're more of a genre person, but if you had a favorite artist, do you have a favorite artist at all that you listen to?
Again, not necessarily. It all depends, because in categories, maybe there are clusters that you listen to. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the beauty of iHeartRadio now. Now you can just play one song, and then all of a sudden, that entire genre of music surrounding that one individual, whatever song they played, winds up popping up.
Yeah, that is a cool thing that you can turn any song after into a radio station.
Right.
That's very cool. Yeah, I'm like with down in Georgia, you have a number of country artists that came out of there, not to forget about REM too, out of Georgia.
I went to school in Georgia, so during that time you had REM, you had Pylon, you had Love Tractor, all came out at that same time, you know, because you watch those while you're drinking beer at the bar.
right.
You know, B-52s, you can't forget the B-52s.
Oh, hell no. B-52s, man. I'm a big fan. I'm a really big fan.
Well, down here, we had Leonard Skinner, and I mean,
oh shit, yeah, man. So, and this is going to be a tough one for you, but it may be not. There's from time to time in people's lives, there's that one song that comes on, and it kind of stops them in their tracks, and they're thinking that song's written for me, or I could have written that song based on the lyrics. Do you have anything like that?
Probably. And now I'm going to spin it to, I guess, Christian, as I can only imagine.
I love that song, by the way. I love that song. That's a good song.
I'm trying to think who the song was written for, and then she decided not to sing it. She brought him up.
Yeah. Well, it's just about time to cue the music for today's episode. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe to the Drop the Needle podcast to stay up to date on our latest episodes. I would also like to take a moment to thank everyone again for tuning in today, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Drop the Needle podcast. A big thanks goes out to our very special guest, Mr. Keith Muller, for joining us today, and I invite you to head over to our show notes where there's a link to the playlist from today's episode. All right, my Drop the Needle posse, like Billy Joel says, from the highs to the lows to the end of the show, this is the end of our show. Until next time, this is Jim Allstott wishing you infinite health, happiness, and the perfect playlist for your life. Thank you again for being the best part of us. Catch you next time.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.